I am very pleased to be joined by writer, actor, director, and an ordained deacon in the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, Tim Kelleher. Tim, thanks so much for getting up early. We were a little concerned that we might be waking you up.
Oh, no, no, no. I need to be woken.
All right.
I'm woke. I'm enlightened. I don't know what I am. But I'm grateful to be on. Thank you very much.
No, the pleasure.
This is crazy.
Now, the pleasure is all mine. Now, I have been following your career for many years. I enjoyed you in the movie Inception. I enjoyed you in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Part 2. I've enjoyed you in a lot of films that you've done in 13 Days, a lot of films that you've done over the years. I have to tell you, though, until the article about your career was sent to me by our mutual friend Joe Ganascoli, who people may remember as Vito in The Sopranos, I had no idea that you were from my home borough and that your aspirations had nothing to do with being an actor. You wanted to be a writer for the Staten Island Advance, a sports writer, no less?
Well, for about 10 minutes, yeah. I mean, I wanted to be a lot of things over every minute of every day. But yeah, for a while I had this like this fantasy, and of course, when The Odd Couple came on the air, I was like, "Wow, Oscar Madison! How can you beat that? Free tickets to every game, you know, we get to live in on Park Avenue, and you know."
So tell me,
yeah, I mean,
So tell me how you went from being a local newspaper delivery boy to being an actor. Trace that journey for us.
Wow, I wish I could. I mean, I'm still trying to understand that myself. Well, you know, growing up, I was always kind of a class clown, you know, doing imitations and getting in trouble and all that kind of thing. And all throughout my entire life, people would always say, "Oh, you should be a comedian or you should be an actor." And I'd say, "Yeah." And I loved all that stuff. I mean, I loved Jerry Lewis, Hans Hall. These are my idols growing up, you know. But when it came time to go to college, and I went to college, and after toward the end of college, I was like, I've always really, really deep down in my heart of hearts, I've always felt this attraction, or if you want to call it a call, a vocation to ministry, to the priesthood. So I made my application to the Jesuits, and I joined the Jesuits as a 22-year-old out of Villanova, and spent a couple of years there and had a fantastic experience. I mean, it really, really changed my life, really helped me to grow up. But, you know, at the end of those 2 years where you're, you know, expected to take vows, I said, yeah, I don't think this is quite right for me, at least now. So, you know, when I knew I didn't want to go down to Washington. I didn't want to go to law school. I didn't want to be a gopher on Capitol Hill, even though I was really interested in politics and international affairs and stuff. So I said, well, you know, I've tried the most serious thing I can think of doing. Why don't I try the most moronic thing I can think of? I talked to a teacher I had at Villanova who was a seasoned veteran actress who'd been on Broadway and everything. She gave me some names of teachers in New York. And I went and I began studying around. And then I joined this real serious program. It was an offshoot of the Neighborhood Playhouse and finished there 3 years, began a theater company in New York. And that's where Joe sort of comes into the picture around those years. It was an incredible thing that we actually built. It was mostly people from that school that we studied with together. And we formed this theater. It was a real, I mean, it's still there. The theater's still there. It's up on the Upper West Side of between Columbus and Amsterdam on 71st Street. So, you know, we were really doing some really good things. And then, you know, I was the artistic director. I was going broke. And so I did a play outside of our company. I got an agent out of it, and next thing you know, I'm in Hollywood, and, you know, borrowing cars and sleeping on couches and getting roles in TV shows and movies.
So, so for people who have followed your career path, I was going to ask you about how you went from being an actor to a deacon, but your path was a little bit somewhat in reverse in that you were already interested in pursuing religious scholarship in a serious manner before you decided to pursue acting.
Yeah, right. That's always been, you know, that, like I said, in my heart of hearts, that's always been the case. And, you know, and I was really very close to going back to the Jesuits And I took this big bus trip, very, you know, romantic bus trip. I was going to go from New York City down to Central America because the Jesuits at the time were fighting in the jungle. You know, they were, you know, liberation theology and all this kind of stuff. So on the way down, I stopped and saw a friend of mine in Kentucky. He said, I want to take you to see a movie. And I said, I haven't come down to Kentucky to go to the movies. And he said, no, this is a really important movie. You should see it. And I said, what is it? He said, it's called Raging Bull. And I said, I grew up around these people. I don't want to see this. It's the last thing I want to see when I'm in the bluegrass of Kentucky. Anyway, long story short, I see it, it blows me away. The screen goes black. And if you may recall, at the end, there's a quotation from John's Gospel. And it's where the guy's being asked, he's been healed, he was blind. And that, you know, they interrogate him. Who did this? Who cured you? And he said, look, I really don't know who it was. All I know is that I was blind, and now I can see. And I was like, oh, my God. Wow. He's like opened the whole, like the scales dropped in my eyes. It's like, you can actually tell stories. And duh, what does Jesus do? He tells parables. That's how he teaches. So I said, I think I could combine these things. So when I went to acting school, I had that really in the back of my mind, but it was, you know, a matter of time. And then when I started directing by default, because we started the theater company and Joe was in the very first play we did, it was like, I don't know any directors, so I'm going to have to direct it myself. And I began to enjoy directing and writing more than I actually did acting, and acting is great, but the creative process, when you're in control of it, it's just a thrill.
We're talking with Tim Kelleher, writer, actor, director, and now an ordained deacon in the, is it the Ukrainian Orthodox Church or the Ukrainian Catholic Church, Tim?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, officially, it's the Ukrainian Orthodox Catholic Church, but just to make things a little clearer, we'll say Orthodox.
So does that mean you celebrate Easter 3.5 weeks from now, not last Sunday?
Well, that's right. Yeah. Not many people are aware of that.
Well, I only know because our owner is a proud member of the Greek Orthodox Church.
Uh-huh.
So he has us celebrate all the Orthodox holidays as well as the traditional Christian holidays.
That's one of the nice things about being, you know, Orthodox or Catholic. You know, if you have Western Christmas on the 25th, and then you have the Orthodox Christmas in January.
So
you have that.
What are the dogmatic differences or the theological differences between Orthodox Christianity, specifically Ukrainian Orthodox Christianity, and sort of rank and file ordinary Catholicism?
Well, again, today there are fewer and fewer really substantial differences that pose real obstacles. There used to be some serious theological issues, which I don't want to get into the weeds with all that for your listeners. But I guess really, with the easiest thing to get a bead on would be that is the office of the Pope. So for the first almost 11 centuries, we were all together, all one. And then there was a breakdown. It was largely political. There were some serious theological issues involved, and Rome and Constantinople, the two main, the East and Western capitals of the churches, actually excommunicated each other.
Mm-hmm.
They've since in the 60s with Pope Paul VI and his counterpart Athenagoras in Constantinople, they withdrew those anathemas. So, you know, at this point, I'd have to say that, and this is going to probably get me in a bit of trouble, but I think most of the serious differences are more political and sociological than they are theological.
Understood.
And it's a shame.
Mm. Yeah, well, we've covered that a little bit on this station, specifically on John Catsimatidis' Sunday morning show, efforts by some people to try and bring a reunion of the Orthodox mm-hmm. and the Catholic Church. But that's a story for another day. So, you know, I really enjoyed your piece for the National Review. It's a headline, Staten Island Boyhood, Marvelous Melancholy Memories. And I'm going to link to it on my Facebook page if people want to check it out. at facebook.com/MoranoFan. Tell folks what prompted you to write this sort of out of the blue. What inspired you to write this piece for National Review?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, I didn't write it specifically for them. In fact, it was kind of odd because it's not the kind of thing that they do typically.
No, right. They do a lot of hard-hitting conservative political stuff.
Right. And that's probably exactly why I decided to send this, of all things. Because, you know, I've written a lot of stuff about politics and culture, especially international affairs. But this was so unlike it. And because people had said to me before, forget about National Review unless you know somebody really important there. It's a very tough gate to crash. So I never really bought it. But this seemed so unlike them. I just said, you know what? What the heck? And I sent it in, and boom! Within a day, I heard back from a very, very kind, really good man, Jack Fowler, who was a big deal there, and he was very discreet. He said, "Well, you know, I like this." He wasn't overly committed, but he said, "I'll pass it on to the people who can make these decisions." Next morning, boom, we're going to do this. You can expect an edit by the end of the day. Not only did I get an edit, I got an editor. I got a guy that I've been reading for years and I really, truly admire, Nick Frankovich. I'm like, do I have to pinch myself? Is this really happening? Mm. Because it ties into this whole nostalgia thing. Because when I was a kid, my father and I used to watch Firing On with Bill Buckley.
Sure.
Get such a kick out of him. And, my father got a kick out of his whole, demeanor. And I got a kick out of that. But I also got a kick out of the way he used words. He's just mesmerized me. And so I learned words like, antediluvian, teleological, and ontological. And I just I get giddy. I was a nerd. But one day I went out and I got myself a little pocket dictionary that I carried around everywhere. And when I was alone, I would read it cover to cover. One day on the basketball court with the older guys, the thing falls out of my pocket. They're like, "What's that?" I'm like, "Nothing." "Hey, give it over here." Oh, it's a dictionary. What are you, some kind of professor? Hey, professor, hey, what's the word for the day, professor? I never lived that down. So cut to all these years later, and next thing you know, I'm actually in this magazine, and they get this huge response from this piece, which is, it seems so unlikely, but people seem to respond, especially to a couple of things that, if you remember, I talk about, when you go to sleep at night and you stare at the ceiling, that feeling of hope that would pull you into the next day, the idea of the morning being an unopened gift. And then I would say, but not all kids knew that kind of hope. And a lot of kids suffered, silently. We used to sometimes make fun of those kids because we had no idea what was going on in their lives and how badly I felt looking back on those occasions where we did make fun of those kids and what it might have cost them, looking back. And a lot of people really responded to that.
Oh, no, I can imagine.
They felt guilty or they were the objects of that kind of.
Now, since you've been in a lot of Hollywood productions and since you've been published now in the pages of National Review and you've written about politics before and clearly have a very thorough understanding of politics, I'm curious if you agree with what we've heard from some other cultural critics and some other actors that tend to be a little bit more on the right, and they've said that there's an anti-conservative bias, and it's gotten worse these days, and that Hollywood in general tends to want to promote an ideology and an agenda that's anathema to traditional America and specifically traditional conservatism. Is that something you agree with?
I think in general it's hard to dispute, really. Anecdotally, I can name a couple of occasions where I actually felt that, and it was silly things, really. I remember going into an audition in Hollywood once, a big household name producer sitting across from me, and I happened to have, I happened to have a copy of a Bill Buckley spy novel, the Black Red Oak series that he did. So maybe I had Stained Glass or Saving the Queen or something, and I put it underneath my chair before the audition started. And he was very shrewd. He looked down and he said, "Are you reading William Buckley?" And I said, And I instantly, I knew where that was going. I said, no, I'm just holding it for a friend. He's like, uh-huh. But I knew, it was like, I was dead. It was a strange thing. And, you know, I have experienced those kinds of things. It definitely has gotten worse. I mean, and you don't have to be in Hollywood to feel that. You know, in the cold, you know, the higher you get in so-called elite society, the more you feel like the Klieg lights are on your every gesture, your every expression of a real belief, you know?
Now, you've worked with some very big names, people like Kevin Costner, Nicolas Cage, Bette Midler. Of all the stars that you've worked with, stars, now people, names that people would recognize, who would you say was the nicest?
Oh, boy, that's tough. That's tough. Let's see. The Staten Island Advance group, they were kind enough to pick up on the National Review thing, and they interviewed me. And I told the story, and I think, well, certainly your Staten Island listeners would know this name, but Robert Loggia.
Ah. Right? You know, you worked with him in the movie Independence Day.
Independence Day, yeah. So, you know, I love him, you know. Since I was a little kid, he had a TV show called T-H-E Cat, where he played a cat burglar who, I guess, worked for the government or something like that. And I just thought he was the coolest guy around. And then to find out that he was from Staten Island, he played football for Wagner, you know, and then following his career, you know, through movies, Scarface, the whole thing. So to actually be on a set with him, he's kind of come across as kind of gruff, man. That's kind of way of talking.
So, Jim... Robert Loggia is somebody that I never met him, I almost cried when he died because I was such a fan.
Oh, yeah. I meet him, and I very sheepishly say, you know, I grew up on Staten Island. He's like, what? Staten Island? So he said, from now on, you come with me every morning. I would jump into his golf cart, and he'd drive us to set. And he used to get a huge kick at it. Like, let's see if we can name every stop on the train from St. George to Tottenham. Come on, you start. And he'd just be laughing like a kid. I was like, I can't believe this is my life now, you know?
That's very funny. Now, did you move to Canada?
I'm talking to you from Vancouver, Canada right now.
Now, what brought you to Canada?
Let's see. I came up here. I was working on a TV movie. I was playing a serial rapist. So I was, what a chick magnet that can be.
Naturally.
Uh-huh. It was based on a true story. Anyway, I met this young woman who was just starting out her career as a novelist. And, you know, cut to now, we're married. And she's a very successful, very, very, very talented novelist who's been shortlisted for the Gilbert Prize, has won all kinds of prizes, and is just about to finish a new book. I couldn't convince her to move back to the States, so we're here.
Now, is Canada really as clean as everybody says?
It's even cleaner.
Really? We have a lot of Canadian listeners. They're always very polite.
Yeah, it's incredible. My first, I tell this story, I hope it's not too off color, but my first trip to Toronto was my very first trip to Canada. I was working on a film, and the last day I was there, I was on the Toronto subway. It was rush hour, and just, you know, one woman sort of, I guess, must have stepped on another woman's foot. She said, "Oh, I'm so terribly sorry," and the other woman said, "Oh, no worries, no worries. Don't you worry at all." Cut to about 10 days later, I'm on Wall Street. In rush hour, I get on the train, and it's packed like sardines, and this little Hispanic guy gets on me, elbowing, and there's this huge black guy there, and he's like, just come from a full day of construction, he's dusty, and he looks down, and he goes, yo, shorty, chill out, this ain't no limo. I said, that's the difference between Toronto and New York.
That's very funny. Tim, I'm actually going to have to leave it there, but I hope we could chat again soon. There's a ton of other stuff
I'd love to go over with you.
Thanks for coming on. And Tim Kelleher, you could check out a lot of stuff that he's done. You can go to his website, which lists a lot of his work on there. It is Tim timkelleher.org. That's TimKelleher.org. If you want to read that national review piece, I've linked to it on my Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan. It's very well done. And as a Staten Islander, it certainly spoke to me.
Thanks, Frank.
You can check it out at facebook.com/MoranoFan. Thanks for the time, Tim. We'll continue with your calls next. 800-848-9222. Straight ahead.